illiterate society. Ghani chose a Quran, Abdullah an image of pen and paper. Many of the ballot reviews went smoothly, but heated arguments, even fistfights, erupted periodically at the compound. On August 19th, protesters swarmed the site, and thugs battled with knives and brass knuckles outside. The more time passed, the more evident it became that the ballot audit would not resolve the crisis. Ghani's surge of votes in the second round from Pashtun areas racked by violence was inherently suspect. Some analysts guessed that if all the fraud could be identified accurately, Abdullah would have won the election. But not every international analyst agreed. Yet the full audit showed that Ghani had won. It was not released for fear that it would touch off violence, a decision Ghani accepted. In late August, Abdullah again threatened to withdraw from the process. On September 6th, Obama again called both candidates to urge them to honor the agreement to finish the count and then form a unity government in which Ghani and Abdullah would share power. The President of the United States was holding Afghanistan together by sheer willpower, one phone call and threat at a time. But the political sandcastle his administration had helped to construct in Kabul still appeared to be crumbling. That same day, September 6th, across the border in Pakistan, another mutiny erupted against the Pakistani military. 13 years earlier, on the eve of the American-led attack on Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, Vice President Dick Cheney had warned that a new war in South Asia might lead to such instability that the Pakistan Army could lose control over the country's nuclear weapons. Then Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley had called this the nightmare scenario. Now the scenario appeared to be drawing closer to reality. Zeeshan Rafiq joined the Pakistan Navy as a lieutenant in 2008. He first went to sea 2 years later as part of Combined Task Force 150, a 25-nation sea patrol operation that deployed ships from Karachi into the Arabian Sea on counterterrorism and anti-piracy missions. The coalition's participants included Pakistan, the United States, and NATO navies. Rafiq chose his country's navy after listening to patriotic songs, and he was motivated to serve. But after a few years, he came to think that the Pakistani military had become the right hand of these infidel forces, and that his country's generals and admirals follow American diktats. One signal from America, and the entire Pakistan army prostrates before them, he reflected. Rafiq once watched an American soldier board a Pakistan Navy ship. Everyone addressed him as Sir, and he was accorded the protocol of an officer, even though he was just an enlisted man. In the war between the Muslim faithful and the infidels, Rafiq wondered, which side is Pakistan's army on? The generals who ran his country assisted in the carpet bombing of Afghanistan. They turned air bases over to the CIA for drone attacks against Muslims. Rafiq read Inspire, Anwar al-Awlaki's English-language internet magazine. He studied the biographies of Faisal Shahzad, the would-be Times Square bomber, and Nidal Hassan, the major who went on a shooting rampage at Fort Hood, Texas. He wanted to do something to remind mujahids around the world that it was important to break the grip of infidels over our seas. Rafiq discovered that another serving Pakistan Navy lieutenant based in Karachi, Owais Jakrani, who was from Balochistan, felt similarly. Jakrani's father was a senior officer in Pakistan's national police. The son, nonetheless, came to believe that his country had become a slave state of America. Jakrani's radicalization manifested itself as complaints to Navy officers that the service was insufficiently Islamic. An internal investigation of him led to his dismissal. Sometime during 2014, Jakrani and Rafiq made contact with al-Qaeda in Waziristan. After Osama bin Laden's death, his longtime Egyptian deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, succeeded him. Zawahiri issued occasional pronouncements but kept a low profile, to avoid bin Laden's fate. Al-Qaeda's local network increasingly consisted of Pakistani militants who had drifted toward the organization and its brand name from other violent groups based in Punjab and Kashmir. One of the leaders of this less Arab, more subcontinent-focused Al-Qaeda fought under the name Asim Umar. His real name, according to the investigations of Indian police and intelligence agencies, was Asim Sanaullah Haq, originally an Indian citizen in the state of Uttar Pradesh. He left there in the mid-1990s and ended up in Pakistan, where he joined Harkat-ul-Mujahideen before moving toward Al-Qaeda. During 2014, Rafiq and Jakrani met him and explained that they could mobilize a sizable group of sympathizers and seize control of an armed Pakistan Navy ship, and then use it to attack the enemies of Islam. The Pakistan Navy was not merely a conventional surface fleet. It was part of the country's systems of nuclear deterrence. In 2012, Pakistan launched a Naval Strategic Forces Command, meaning a command focused on the deployment of nuclear weapons at sea. The country's military leadership sought to develop a nuclear triad, akin to that deployed by the United States. That is, systems that would allow the firing of nuclear arms from aircraft, from land bases, or from the sea. The advantage of a triad is that it makes it difficult for an adversary that also has nuclear arms to launch a preemptive first strike, because at least some of the targeted country's dispersed nukes and delivery systems would likely survive and could be used in retaliation. While developing their triads, the United States, Russia, Britain, and France placed special emphasis on submarines armed with nuclear missiles because these stealthy undersea vessels would be particularly hard for an enemy to locate and destroy during a first strike. Pakistan had not yet acquired and deployed enough high-quality submarines to place the sea leg of its nuclear triad only with those vessels. Analysts assumed that Pakistan would also consider placing nuclear weapons aboard Navy ships that carried cruise missiles with enough range to reach India, which of course was by far the most likely adversary to enter into a nuclear war with Pakistan. PNS Zulfikar, a Chinese-built seven-story Pakistani frigate, which typically had 250 to 300 sailors and officers aboard, was one such ship. On December 19th and 21st, 2012, the frigate reportedly test-fired Chinese-made C-802 land-attack cruise missiles, which have a range of about 180 miles. C-802 missiles can fly as low as 25 meters above the surface of the ocean, making them difficult to detect by radar. The missiles can also be fitted with a small nuclear warhead with a yield of 2 to 4 kilotons, or about 15 to 25% of the explosive force of the atomic bomb the United States dropped on Hiroshima, Japan, in 1945. Around the time that it launched its Strategic Naval Command, Pakistan also accelerated its development of small or tactical nuclear weapons, like the ones that might fit on C-802 missiles. During the first decade after the invention of the atomic bomb, the United States, too, had built and deployed small nuclear bombs that could be dropped from planes or even fired from special artillery guns. The United States sent the small bombs to Europe and planned to use them on the battlefield against Soviet troops and tanks if a land war erupted across the Iron Curtain. It was only later in the Cold War that the idea of using atomic bombs on a battlefield as if they were just a more potent artillery shell became anathema in most nuclear strategy circles. Nuclear deterrence between the United States and the Soviet Union evolved into more of an all-or-nothing proposition under the rubric of mutually assured destruction, or MAD. At the peak of MAD, each side had more than 20,000 nuclear bombs that were so powerful that any full-on nuclear exchange would have effectively ended human civilization. The effects of nuclear war became so dramatic and unthinkable that it made such a war, or any conventional war that might go nuclear, less likely. That was the theory, at least. India and Pakistan tested nuclear weapons in 1998. As their version of mutual nuclear deterrence evolved, It displayed some parallels to the position of the United States in Europe during the 1950s. The United States feared a massive conventional blitzkrieg by Soviet forces and saw small nuclear weapons as a way to counter such an invasion. In South Asia, a similar factor was Pakistan's fear of a conventional armored invasion by India. Because India has a much larger military than Pakistan, as well as a larger economy and population, it might be expected to prevail in a long war. Pakistan acquired nuclear bombs to deter India from considering a conventional tank and infantry invasion, no matter how provoked India might feel from time to time by Pakistani-sponsored terrorism. For this defense to work, Pakistani generals had to plant doubt in the minds of Indian leaders about whether the generals were really rash enough to be the first to use nuclear weapons in anger since 1945. The development of small or tactical nuclear weapons aided Pakistan in this respect. Small atomic bombs might be dropped on a desert battlefield against Indian troops, away from population centers, or they might be fired on cruise missiles against an isolated Indian military base. The use of even a small nuclear weapon on a battlefield would likely shock the world and provoke international intervention to end the war, perhaps before India could achieve its war aims. Overall, the existence and deployment of small nukes by Pakistan made it more likely that its generals would actually use them, which in turn deepened doubts in the minds of Indian leaders about how costly a war with Pakistan might become. That is, in Pakistan's twisted and dangerous logic, small nuclear weapons strengthened deterrence. Yet there were obvious downsides. One was that building and spreading out so many small, loose bombs exacerbated the threat that terrorists might try to steal them, or might come across them inadvertently. Lieutenant Zeeshan Rafiq and former Lieutenant Owais Jakrani knew all about the PNS Zulfikar's internal security systems. After they made contact with Al-Qaeda in 2014, they developed elaborate plans, seemingly derived from Hollywood thrillers, to defeat that security in order to seize control of the ship and its weapons, including its 76mm gun and its C-802 cruise missiles. One part of their plan was to exploit a particular weakness of the security system, as Rafiq put it, namely that the lockers and rooms of officers are not checked. Rafiq and other officers successfully smuggled weapons aboard the PNS Zulfikar in batches in their backpacks and stowed them in lockers. The next part of their plan was to make duplicate keys of the doors to the missile rooms and the operations rooms, so that these rooms could be accessed without the knowledge of the ship's commanding officers. Here, too, the insider knowledge of the two lieutenants offered an advantage. They planned to sneak into the magazine room of the 76mm gun to load its shells before they moved to seize control of the ship. They also understood that it was possible to prime and operate both the gun and the C-802 missiles outside of the ship's main operations room, in an alternate area below, on the second deck. The C-802 missiles could be operated manually from the second deck, while the missile's automated system was off. With their duplicate keys, they could accomplish this. The conspirators also scoped out the armed security guards they expected to find on the PNS Zulfikar. These were elite commandos from the Special Services Group. There were typically 5 Pakistani commandos aboard when the frigate sailed to join NATO for operations of Combined Task Force 150. The commandos were deployed in part to protect the ship in case Somali or other pirates attacked. Rafiq, Jakrani, and their co-conspirators devised a plan to kill them or hold them at bay. First, they would bring 24 or so co-conspirators aboard the ship, some after the ship was at sea. They would try to avoid any confrontation with the crew as the PNS Zulfikar sailed toward American and other vessels operating in the coalition. Their target was the USS Supply, a lightly defended American supply and refueling vessel. According to Rafiq, the American logistics ship's defense was assigned to a United States Navy frigate that always shadowed it, no more than a few miles away. When the PNS Zulfikar got close, They would use their duplicate keys to arm and fire its big artillery gun and its cruise missiles to secretly attack the U.S. ship, as one of the conspirators put it, before the Pakistani crew aboard realized what was happening. They would use the 76mm gun to destroy USS Supply, and then turn the C-802 cruise missiles on whatever American ship came to its defense. After they launched their attack on the United States Navy, they expected the crew of the PNS Zulfikar to try to stop them, but since it doesn't take much time to fire missiles, they would already have done a lot of damage. At that point, they planned to defend the frigate's armory so the Pakistani crew could not arm themselves. They also would lock all the doors and hatches between the second and third decks to barricade themselves below. They would take the frigate's commanding officer as a hostage and force him to order the crew to abandon ship by donning life jackets and jumping into the sea. Once in full control of the PNS Zulfikar, the conspirators planned to use all of the frigate's weapons, the 76mm gun, torpedoes, anti-aircraft gun, Schalke, and C-802 missiles, to attack any U.S. Navy ship. They would continue to fight until the PNS Zulfikar was destroyed, or until the mutineers themselves were killed in action. They hoped to use the ship's communication systems to reach the media and tell the world about this entire operation. Early in September 2014, Al-Qaeda publicly announced a new branch, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. Under the leadership of Asim Umar, the Indian from Uttar Pradesh, Al-Qaeda's leaders explained that they had worked for some time to recruit and unite militants from disparate Pakistani groups. The announcement seemed designed to provide Al-Qaeda with new visibility and relevance at a time when the Islamic State had started to rise to prominence in Syria and Iraq, and had started to recruit local allies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. An Al-Qaeda member, Hassan Yusuf, explained that the group's main motivation in forming the new branch came in the wake of the American defeat and withdrawal from Afghanistan. This jihad will not end. America's defeat is only the prelude. A withdrawal that was seen in Washington as an intelligent winding down of an unsustainable war was inevitably understood by jihadists worldwide as a historic victory and a source of new momentum. On September 6, 2014, in Karachi, at dawn, Rafiq and Jakrani boarded the PNS Zulfikar in Navy uniforms, with their service cards displayed. A number of co-conspirators in Marine uniforms approached through the harbor in a dinghy. An alert Pakistan Navy gunner noticed that the Marines were carrying AK-47s, which are not normally issued in the Navy. He fired a warning shot. A full-on gun battle erupted. SSG commandos joined the fray to defend the ship. When it was over, by one count, 11 attackers died, including Rafiq and Jakrani. They never had a chance to access the weapons they had smuggled aboard or to use the duplicate keys they had made to the C-802 missile room. The Pakistani defense of the PNS Zulfikar was remarkably professional and successful. Yet there was a disturbing postscript to Al-Qaeda's strike. About 6 weeks after the attack, India's principal external intelligence service, the Research and Analysis Wing, citing agent reporting from Karachi, informed India's National Security Advisor that a nuclear warhead had been on board the PNS Zulfikar at the time of the attack. If their plan had succeeded, Rafiq and Jakrani would have had more on their hands than they expected, by this account. It was possible that India put a false story out to stir up global alarm about terrorism and nuclear security in Pakistan. Yet if the Indian report was accurate, September 6, 2014, would mark the first known armed terrorist attack in history against a facility holding nuclear weapons. Judging by Pakistan's trajectory, it was unlikely to be the last. On September 14th, Ghani and Abdullah completed negotiations on a 4-page power-sharing agreement, under which the former would become president of Afghanistan, succeeding Karzai, and the latter would appoint a chief executive of Afghanistan to run the country day-to-day. When Abdullah again threatened to back out of the deal a few days later, John Kerry telephoned him and issued a warning on speakerphone to the candidate and about 30 of his aides. If you don't come to agreement now, today, the possibilities for Afghanistan will become very difficult, if not dangerous, the Secretary of State warned yet again. I really need to emphasize to you that if you do not have an agreement, if you do not move to a unity government, the United States will not be able to support Afghanistan. Abdullah gave in. At the end of September, a new government limped into being, with Ghani as president. Karzai delivered a bitter farewell speech in which he reiterated his conspiracy theories about American motivations and did not mention the soldiers' lives sacrificed or the billions of dollars expended to develop Afghanistan. America did not want peace for Afghanistan because it had its own agendas and goals here, Karzai said. Ghani retained Nabil at NDS, the only holdover from Karzai's cabinet. As Kayani and Pasha had done with the waffling Karzai, the new leadership of the Pakistan Army tried to encourage Ghani to cut a deal with Islamabad. Ghani met with Kayani's successor as Army Chief, Rahil Sharif, and the newest ISI director, General Rizwan Akhtar. As Amrullah Saleh had experienced before him, Nabil found himself cut out of meetings between the president and the Pakistani leadership, uncertain about what sort of accommodation they might be exploring. Nabil later discovered that ISI had installed in the Ark Palace two sets of encrypted hotlines between Ghani and the Pakistan Army and spy service leadership. He eventually resigned. After fitful efforts, Ghani withdrew from negotiations about peace with Pakistan. From the first days following September 11th, America's principal goal in Afghanistan was to destroy al-Qaeda. After more than a decade of effort, al-Qaeda remained active, lethal, and adaptive. Osama bin Laden and many of his former lieutenants were dead, and the ability of the group's original branch in Pakistan and Afghanistan to carry out complex attacks in Europe and America had been greatly reduced. Yet bin Laden's deputy and successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, remained in charge, presumably in hiding in Pakistan. New al-Qaeda branches formed in Pakistan to attack India and elsewhere in South Asia carried out well-organized strikes. Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent claimed responsibility for the murders of four free-thinking Bangladeshi writers, including Avijit Roy, an American citizen. Other al-Qaeda allies based in Pakistan remained active across borders. Some al-Qaeda cells returned to Afghanistan as security there deteriorated. And the broader goal announced by George W. Bush in 2001, to defeat al-Qaeda and its ideological allies worldwide, and to suppress the threat of terror generally, lay in shambles. The al-Qaeda branch seeded in Iraq to challenge the American invasion of that country morphed into the Islamic State, recruited tens of thousands of volunteers to Syria and Iraq, and seized territory there, in Libya and Afghanistan. Its operatives and followers killed hundreds of civilians in France, Belgium, Germany, and elsewhere. In 2014, more than 32,000 people died in terrorist violence worldwide, a record number. This represented a five-fold increase from 2001 and an 80% increase from 2013. Almost four out of five deaths from terrorism in 2014 took place in just five countries: Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Nigeria. The first three of those nations remained embroiled in civil violence directly set off by the American-led invasions that followed September 11th. The United States also sought to stabilize and develop Afghanistan, to prevent it from becoming a terrorist sanctuary again. For many Afghans, life did improve, as billions of dollars poured in from the United States, European capitals, Japan, the Gulf states, and other donors. The aid was often poorly managed and siphoned off by corrupt Afghan elites and criminal networks. Yet it made a difference. Average life expectancy improved from about 55 years to just above 60 years. the economy grew almost tenfold, from about $2.5 billion in estimated gross domestic product in 2001 to about $20 billion in 2014. School enrollment quintupled, and after the dark, unplugged years of Taliban rule, 9 out of 10 Afghans gained access to modern communications, including smartphones. The population grew in size by about half, to 30 million, partly because several million refugees returned home, lured by the growing economy and the promise of peace. Yet Afghanistan nonetheless remained one of the world's poorest countries, with more than a third of its citizens living in poverty. And its government and security forces remained almost entirely dependent on outside subsidies of doubtful longevity. The war that followed the American-led invasion of 2001 caused about 140,000 deaths directly by the end of NATO's formal combat role in 2014, according to estimates assembled by researchers at Brown University. This compared to the estimated 1 million to 2 million Afghan lives lost during the decade after the Soviet invasion. The dead after 2001 included about 26,000 Afghan civilians and about 21,000 Pakistani civilians. The extent of Pakistani losses was one difference from the wars of the 1980s and the 1990s. In those decades, Afghanistan's wars spilled over into Pakistan in the form of loose weapons, sectarian hatred, and heroin addiction. But there were fewer cases inside Pakistan of terrorism inspired by the ideologies of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. After the American-led intervention, Pakistan gradually fell victim to terrorism carried out in the name of a broader revolutionary Islamic politics. To some extent, the country was destabilized by Al-Qaeda's opportunistic escape across the border from Afghanistan under U.S. military pressure during late 2001 and 2002. But to a much greater extent, the violence reflected how Pakistan reaped the price of a state policy that nurtured and accommodated violent jihadi groups. Hamid Karzai's conspiracy theories notwithstanding, the United States had no coherent geopolitical vision when it counterattacked Afghanistan after September 11th, other than perhaps to try to avoid destabilizing Pakistan, a goal it failed to achieve. Gradually, American diplomats, intelligence and military leaders in the second Bush term, and then the Obama administration, did come to believe that access to at least one or two military bases in Afghanistan would be helpful to counter regional terror groups. Even after the withdrawal of the great bulk of American troops, the remaining bases would become a South Asian link in a chain of American counter-terrorist outposts from Kurdistan to the Gulf to Djibouti to East Asia. Whether Afghanistan would remain stable enough after 2020 to accommodate such a modest foothold in the region looked questionable. The rising, embittered skepticism toward Pakistan at the Pentagon, in Congress, and at the CIA, engendered by America's experience of the Afghan War after 2001, helped to solidify ties between the United States and India. After 2001, the two countries assessed increasingly that they shared a common enemy. Yet India proved to be cautious about working too closely or explicitly with Washington and Afghanistan or the region. The country's noisy democratic politics contained a large strain of skepticism about American power. And India's security establishment remained wary of taking risks in Afghanistan, say, by providing lethal military aid and troops to bolster Afghan forces against the Taliban, that might confirm Pakistan's fears of encirclement and thereby provoke ISI to retaliate by sponsoring more terrorism inside India. The fallout from the Afghan war also persuaded Pakistan's leaders, after 2011, to give up on any strategic partnership with Washington and to deepen ties to Beijing. This effectively opened Pakistani territory to Chinese companies and military planners to construct transit corridors and bases that might improve China's regional influence and links to the Middle East. Overall, the war left China with considerable latitude in Central Asia, without having made any expenditure of blood, treasure, or reputation. In the decades after helicopters lifted the last Americans off the roof of the United States Embassy in Saigon, a generation of U.S. military leaders and spies lost touch with the challenges of carrying out long expeditionary wars in poor countries in an age of saturated media. As the Soviet Union wobbled and then collapsed, the size and technological advantages of the U.S. military ushered in an era of global battlefield superiority. After September 11th, the shockingly rapid triumph of the CIA-inspired campaign to overthrow the Taliban so exceeded expectations that it blinded some of its architects to their own limitations. No small part of NATO's ultimate failure to stabilize Afghanistan flowed from the disastrous decision by George W. Bush to invade Iraq in 2003. That war inflamed and mobilized deeper resistance to American counterterrorism policy and warfare in the Muslim world. The Taliban's comeback, America's initial inattention to it, and the attraction for some Afghans and Pakistanis of the Taliban's ideology of national resistance under Islamic principles, all these sources of failure cannot be understood in isolation from the Iraq War. The Bush administration committed other unforced strategic errors in conceiving a global war on terror. The prison at Guantanamo and the CIA's torture of Al-Qaeda suspects in secret offshore prisons, for example. Yet it also seems likely that, even without Iraq or Guantanamo, the United States would have struggled to achieve many of its goals in Afghanistan. Primarily, this was because two administrations, led by presidents of different political parties, could not resolve essential questions about the conflict. Did they truly believe that Afghanistan's independence and stability was more important than Pakistan's stability? Why did they accept ISI's support for the Taliban, even when it directly undermined American interests and cost American lives? If they were to try to stop ISI's covert action, what risks were they prepared to take? Inside Afghanistan, which was more important? To work with unsavory but sometimes effective warlords and militias against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? Or to promote decent government, even if the attempt to do so created instability? How important was drug enforcement if the campaign risked alienating farmers and laborers in Taliban country? The Taliban might be abhorrent, but did the movement pose a direct threat to the United States? If the Afghan war could be settled only by peace talks that included as much of the Taliban as possible, as many at the highest levels of the Obama administration came to believe after 2010, why was this daunting project left to a secret cell of negotiators and not made a higher, more explicit priority of the United States, as were the comparably risky negotiations with Iran and Cuba undertaken during Obama's second term? The United States and its allies went barreling into Afghanistan after September 11th because they felt they had no alternative. The complex wars and the political strategies that followed were often reactive, improvised, and informed by illusions. Yet America did not fight alone or for cynical gain. The United States was one of 59 countries, or more than a quarter of the world's nations, to deploy troops or provide other aid to Afghanistan in an attempt to stabilize the country after the Taliban's fall. The motivations of the political leaders, military volunteers, and aid workers who participated in the war varied greatly. For many American and European generals and counterterrorism specialists, the critical mission was security, to deprive Al-Qaeda of the territorial sanctuary from which it had been able to organize such a devastating terrorist raid on New York and Washington on September 11th. A secondary aim was to prove that the Compact of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, founded on the premise that an attack on one member was an attack on all, had meaning, and that NATO could operate, if necessary, outside its defensive perimeter in the West. Yet many lower-ranking volunteers who came to Afghanistan from around the world after 2001 saw themselves on a humanitarian mission. A more stable and prosperous Afghanistan restored to independence and peaceful sovereignty, restored to its best 20th century example of ethnic and linguistic pluralism, might contribute to international security. A strong, rising Afghanistan, relieved of some of its recent suffering, was, for many of these volunteers, an end in itself. September 11th made plain how the security of ordinary Afghans was connected to the security of ordinary Americans and Europeans. Yet the problems of restoring stability to Afghanistan proved to be rooted not only in the patterns of terrorism, but also in the country's massive underdevelopment. On September 11th, Afghanistan languished at the very bottom of United Nations and World Bank tables measuring poverty and human potential. Even that ranking was a guess, because the country no longer produced reliable statistics. Less than a quarter of all school-age children were enrolled. Girls were even less likely than that to learn to read and write. The wars since 1979 had ripped jagged losses in most Afghan families. The international community has an unimpressive record of fostering rapid economic development in extremely poor, war-shattered countries. From the 1980s on, infrastructure investment, trade, and free market policies transformed the lives of hundreds of millions of Asians and Latin Americans, fostering new middle classes and reducing the risks of war between states. By the 1990s, a number of coastal African nations had embarked on similarly transforming paths of economic growth, international trade, and middle class formation. Yet the political economy of Afghanistan in 2001 had more in common with the world's most intractable cases, Somalia, Haiti, the Central African Republic, or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Both administrations that fought the Afghan War between 2001 and 2014 tolerated and even promoted stovepiped, semi-independent campaigns waged simultaneously by different agencies of American government. The easiest way for the National Security Council and the President to resolve policy conflicts among the CIA, the Pentagon Policy Offices, the DEA, Central Command, DIA, and the State Department was to tell each agency, "Do it your way, but follow our broad guidance." The agencies often interpreted White House policy memos liberally. The agencies proved to be more inclined to apologize in the event of a perceived transgression than to implement policy they did not like. It is hardly surprising that policies riddled with such internal contradictions and unresolved analytical questions failed to achieve the extraordinarily ambitious aim of stabilizing war-shattered Afghanistan. The war instead became a humbling case study in the limits of American power. It became a story of mismatched means and ends. Rich, technologically advanced, and often ably staffed, the United States foreign policy, intelligence, and military machine was built for competition with other states, to win conventional wars against opposing armies, to negotiate treaties with professional diplomats, to patrol sea lanes, or to steal the secrets of other governments. At those sorts of tasks, the machine remained competent. It was never well equipped to build good governance in deeply impoverished, violent landscapes, or to win asymmetric conflicts with ideological, media-savvy guerrillas on short timelines. The ISI proved to be a formidable adversary, but it was not omnipotent. It suffered from the same corruption and weakness that plagued the entire Pakistani state. America failed to achieve its aims in Afghanistan for many reasons. Underinvestment in development and security immediately after the Taliban's fall, the drains on resources and the provocations caused by the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, corruption fed by NATO contracting and CIA deal-making with strongmen, and military hubris at the highest levels of the Pentagon. Yet the failure to solve the riddle of ISI and to stop its covert interference in Afghanistan became, ultimately, the greatest strategic failure of the American war. In the autumn of 2014, the United States military finished the massive project of tearing down or turning over to Afghan forces the sprawling infrastructure built in the country since 2001, to prepare for the official end of NATO combat operations at year's end. The United States operated 715 bases around Afghanistan. It would ultimately keep only 12 to carry out the forthcoming mission of advising and assisting the Afghan National Army and police. The Afghan National Army took control of about 225 of the former American bases. The police took another 118. Most of the rest were closed or abandoned. Altogether, the United States handed over to Afghanistan about $900 million of foreign excess real property, military hand-me-downs of various kinds, and destroyed another $46 million worth because the items were too sensitive or impractical to transfer. The largest single gift was Camp Levenek, the United States Marines base in Helmand, valued at $235 million. The last Marines lowered the American flag and flew away in late October. The war against the Taliban grew deadlier for Afghan civilians and troops during 2014. More than 10,000 Afghan civilians died or suffered injuries during the year, the highest number since the United Nations began counting civilian casualties there in 2009. The UN judged the Taliban responsible for almost three-quarters of the civilian casualties through roadside bombings and other indiscriminate attacks. But hard ground battles between Afghan forces and the Taliban also took a heavy toll, more than 3,000 civilian casualties. The Afghan National Army and police suffered 4,634 deaths and many more wounded, a rate of casualties that Lieutenant General Joseph Anderson, a senior American commander in Kabul, termed not sustainable. The Taliban consolidated control in rural areas, threatened highways, but captured no major cities. The war remained a bloody stalemate, but one in which the government's position, high casualties in the security forces, high rates of desertion and attrition, and paralysis within the new unity government of Ghani and Abdullah, looked precarious. By the year's end, the unhappy partners had yet to name a cabinet. On the Taliban side, there were some signs of fragmentation as opportunists and Pakistani militants repositioned themselves for a post-American war. During the summer and fall, through video messages and fragmentary statements, various Pakistani and Afghan Taliban commanders offered support for the Islamic State. Some of the declarations of allegiance were ecumenical expressions of support for any righteous jihadist movement of the Islamic State's character. Later in the year came more outright defections to ISIS. The black flags of ISIS flew in place of Taliban banners in some districts of Nangarhar, Helmand, Farah, and Logar. On February 15, 1989, the final armored column of the limited contingent of Soviet forces in Afghanistan, as the Soviet 40th Army called itself, crossed over the Friendship Bridge above the Amu Darya River, officially ending Soviet combat operations in the country. Thousands of Soviet advisers remained behind. General Boris V. Gromov, the final Soviet commander of the war, sat in the column's last armored personnel carrier. On the bridge, the vehicle stopped, and Gromov climbed down. He walked the final yards on foot, never looking back on Afghanistan. On the Soviet side of the border, his teenage son greeted him with a bouquet of flowers. General John Campbell, the final commander of the International Security Assistance Force for Afghanistan, wanted a less dramatic and final-looking ceremony. The mission was changing, but the number of troops in country was not. This was by no means a final withdrawal. He also had to manage security arrangements to be sure the Taliban did not disrupt his ceremony. On December 28, 2014, a Sunday, Campbell invited Afghan government officials, diplomats, and journalists to a gymnasium inside NATO's secure perimeter in Kabul. The ceremony program noted that attendees should lie flat on the ground in the event of a rocket attack. A small military brass band played in a corner as Campbell rolled up the ISAF flag and unfurled a new green one, emblazoned with the words, "Resolute Support," as the new advisory mission would be known. Campbell promised a bedrock partnership with Afghanistan. "The road before us remains challenging, but we will triumph," he said. the Taliban issued a statement declaring that the infidel powers that had thought they would turn Afghanistan into their colony instead stood on the brink of defeat. From Washington, President Barack Obama issued a statement of his own. The end of American combat in Afghanistan was a milestone for the country, he said. He thanked the American troops and intelligence officers who had devastated, he said, the core al-Qaeda leadership, delivering justice to Osama bin Laden, disrupting terrorist plots, and saving countless American lives. Finally, Obama went on, after much sacrifice, the longest war in American history is coming to a responsible conclusion. As it happened, the American war in Afghanistan would officially start again in just over 12 months, this time against the Islamic State's new Afghan affiliates. The longest war in the country's history would be longer still. Epilogue. Victim Impact Statements. After Abdul Sabur murdered Darren Loftus and Robert Marchanti at the Interior Ministry in February 2012, American and Afghan intelligence and police officers tried to hunt him down. At one point, a signals intelligence operation traced Sabur's cell phone to Iran. Among the Afghan officers who took an interest in the case was General Mohammad Ayub Salanghi, a former Kabul police chief who had risen to become deputy interior minister. Salanghi worked closely with American and European generals and police trainers. He was an Afghan nationalist who spoke out regularly against ISI, accusing the service of providing military-grade explosives to the Taliban and sending Pakistani commandos in disguise to fight inside Afghanistan. Salanghi came from the same area of Parwan province as Sabur, just to the north of Kabul, so the case had an aspect of personal honor. As months and then years passed, the general made sure that Sabur remained on the wanted list. Early in 2016, after living in Iran for 4 years, Sabur returned to Parwan. The NDS had instructed local informants to notify the service if he turned up. In the end, it wasn't hard to track him down. That winter, Sabur openly hosted neighbors for discussions about Islam. Police arrested him on March 19th while he was preaching in favor of the enemies of Afghanistan, as the Interior Ministry put it. On April 21st, in Kabul, the police arranged for Sabur, who was now 32 years old, to make a brief appearance before the Afghan media. He entered a Kabul briefing room in handcuffs, wearing a blindfold. A policeman removed the cloth as he stood before microphones. Sabur introduced himself and recited a verse from the Quran. God says it is obligatory upon you to wage jihad against the enemies of your religion, creed, honor, and pride. He offered a brief and unrepentant confession. Since the coalition forces have come to this country, what good have they done? He asked. What is the service they have provided to this land? He recalled the burning of the Qurans at Bagram Airfield in early 2012. I couldn't control myself, he admitted. He was grateful to God and did not care if I die for this. In Florida, Holly Loftus learned about Sabur's arrest by a text message from Peggy Marchanti, who had been given some fragmentary information about the case by Army liaisons. Eventually, she contacted military lawyers from the Judge Advocate General's Corps, or JAG Corps. They explained that Sabur would be tried for murder later in the summer. The families had an opportunity to submit victim impact statements to the court in Parwan. Victim impact evidence, typically written statements or videos submitted by family members of crime victims, is a relatively recent feature of American jurisprudence, at times controversial, particularly in capital cases, because of the emotional hold such testimony can have on juries. In the redevelopment of Afghan law and justice after the Taliban's fall, shaped by European and American finance and advice, victim impact statements became part of some Afghan proceedings. The eldest of Holly's two daughters, Allison, was 17 years old. For the past few summers, she had participated in Gold Star Teen Adventures, a program for children of special operations soldiers killed in the line of duty. She had learned scuba diving and had decided to study marine biology in college. Camille, the younger daughter, was 14. She was enrolled in a pre-professional ballet program and was about to attend a summer intensive organized by the American Ballet Theater. For both girls and Holly, the news of Sabour's arrest and the invitation to write about the loss of their father and husband turned the spring of 2016 into a season of new emotional trials. Holly tried to seek out professional counseling for all of them again, although between her work schedule and the constraints of her health insurance network, it wasn't easy. For her part, Holly had never expected justice for Darren's murder. She thought it was appropriate that Afghans who respected her husband's memory had tracked Sabour down. It wasn't comforting, exactly, but it came full circle. For 4 years, she had dreamed from time to time that Darren had come home. The dreams were not of a gauzy, running-through-the-wildflowers reunion, but routine, matter-of-fact. The two of them picked up where they had left off. She talked with Darren about what had happened since he died, who in the military had been difficult with her, who had been kind. Somehow, with Sabour's arrest, it felt to her now as if that fantasy might vanish. Holly and both of her daughters decided to go ahead and submit victim impact statements. Allison's was, "without a doubt, the most difficult thing I have ever had to write," as she noted near the start. It ran to several pages. She was 13 when her father was killed, and, "over the last 4 years, I have struggled with heartbreak, grief, anger, and devastation." Revisiting her loss after Sabour's arrest had redoubled all the feelings of bereavement I have had since the Air Force knocked on my door 4 years ago. She recounted her father's qualities, the richness of their relationship, her memories of him, and her struggle with depression since his death. Over the Memorial Day weekend, she had visited her father's grave at Arlington National Cemetery and played taps on the trumpet. "As I played the tribute for him," she wrote, "I was faced with the truth that my dad will not ever be able to tell me how proud he is of me, or be able to listen to the music that I have composed about his life and death." She continued, "To the man who murdered my father, you have caused so many people so much deep grief, pain, and agony. You cannot possibly imagine the pain I have endured and continue to endure because of your actions. I would never wish these feelings upon anyone." Holly's youngest daughter, Camille, had turned 15 since Sabour's arrest. She had been 10 when her father was murdered. She composed a 5-paragraph statement for the court. "My dad believed that we all worshiped the same God," she wrote. "We are all just trying to live our lives in service of God, always trying to be the best person we can be." She continued, "Some people may think it outrageous for me to offer my forgiveness to someone who has changed my life in such an irreparable way, but I can say only this. God forgives us, and he has commanded his people to forgive each other and to live to be more like him. That does not mean I believe there should be no consequences. One may be forgiven, but one must still receive consequences for one's actions. In order to receive forgiveness, one must express remorse. So, my forgiveness will come to you if you are qualified to accept it. I say all this in remembrance of my father." In her statement, Holly described her long journey with Darren, including their time as Peace Corps volunteers in Papua New Guinea before her husband joined the Air Force. "In our country, we marry for love," she wrote. "And Darren was the love of my life, my best friend, the person I could trust most in the world, and also the smartest person I know. He held 3 master's degrees, and wanted to get a PhD as well. He had studied the history and culture of Afghanistan, and he spoke Pashto and Dari. He respected the Afghan people and culture. She quoted a letter Darren had written to his daughters when he deployed to Afghanistan the first time. "My reasons for going to Afghanistan include an honorable sense of duty to help others. If I had stayed home and not volunteered to go, I would have always wondered what I could have contributed. I don't want to sit around wondering if I could have done something to help their children go to school, their sick people get better, or their poor people have a better life. I don't want to be in the situation where I wonder how I could have helped. And so that's why I'm going to Afghanistan. I know this is the honorable thing to do, and that's why I have to be away from you for a while." Holly's statement concluded, "I wish to thank General Salanghi and the Afghan National Police for continuing to search for the shooter, for never giving up over the last 4 years, and for bringing this murderer to justice. I also wish to thank the Honorable Chief and members of the National Security Branch of the Parwan Province Primary Court for hearing my statement and for ensuring that justice be done." Sabur's trial opened on October 5, 2016. The Afghan prosecutor rose to introduce facts about the defendant. Sabur had a ninth-grade education. He had worked at the Ministry of Education before joining the Ministry of Interior. At one point, he had traveled to Pakistan and studied the Quran at a madrasa in Peshawar. In 2012, after he learned from news reports about the burning of the Qurans at Bagram, he carried food to a local mullah and discussed the provocation. He decided that he should act. At the ministry a few days later, he loaded a pistol in the bathroom. He knocked on the door of the office where Loftus and Marshanti worked. He pretended to have a stomach illness and said he needed to get some medicine from a locker. Then he shot the two men to death. As he walked out of the building, he told an Afghan he passed that the sound of gunshots was from the Americans fighting with each other. He dropped his pistol in some trash, traveled to Herat province, and then on to Iran. The prosecutor detailed Sabur's confessions after his arrest and presented ballistics evidence about the shootings. Sabur interrupted the proceedings from time to time by reciting verses and parables from the Quran. Sabur's lawyers denied his guilt and presented several defenses. They said his confessions had been coerced by torture, that members of his family had been wrongfully detained to intimidate him, and that he was not in adequate health to stand trial. Two American captains read out victim impact statements from the Marshanti and Loftus families. The prosecutor, in rebuttal of the defense case, played Sabur's confessions on video, where he admitted readily to the shootings. "What of the video statements you made?" the judge asked the defendant. "You were not being intimidated then, when you made that confession. What do you want this court to do?" Sabur said that he had done nothing wrong. "God is unblemished," he added. The court recessed for half an hour. When the judge returned, he found Sabur guilty and sentenced him to 20 years in prison. Sabur appealed but lost a second hearing. His sentence was upheld. He had one remaining avenue of appeal to the Supreme Court. Holly realized the case was like a scab that was going to be picked at for a while. She shared the news of the verdict and sentence with her daughters. They did not have much of a reaction. Holly thought that Darren would be satisfied that the sentence was a long prison term instead of the death penalty. It was impossible to speak for him now that he was gone, but he would have said, she thought, that it did not make sense for one more person to die. During the 7 months between March 2016 and the opening of Abdul Sabur's trial, more than 4,500 Afghan soldiers and police died in combat against the Taliban and the Islamic State, and more than 8,500 others were wounded. The casualties were so heavy that within the police forces, at least, they outpaced recruitment of fresh volunteers. Taliban guerrillas threatened the provincial capital of Kunduz in the north and Lashkar-Gah in Helmand in the south. All of the country's major cities remained in the government's hands, but the roads and countryside between them were often controlled or influenced by Taliban guerrillas. The Afghan state Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah presided over, when they weren't fighting,